Les colloques du Collège de France.
It's an honor to be part of this symposium at the Collège de France focused on the social production of health inequalities with scholars whose work is very careful, smart, and provocative. And it's an honor to present here in the Collège de France for the first time a concept that I am still in the process of developing. This is a different kind of lecture than I'm used to giving, in which I'm rethinking my research through this new concept, exploring what the concept allows or pushes us to see, as well as the implications it has for health. As a physician, I'm especially interested in bodies, health, and what can be done to support them. As a sociocultural anthropologist, I'm interested in the broader social, political, economic, and cultural formations that either support or harm the well-being of individuals and populations. And I'm happy to talk about other ideas and other research afterward. So today, I'd like to explore together with you this concept that I'm working through. First, I'll define what I'm calling enviroanthropogenesis and its relation to health inequalities. Next, I'll take a little tour through some of my previous research projects that has led me to this conceptualization, and then I'll close with some of the implications of this concept for health and what can be done. Before we discuss the definition, I'd like to think a bit about the term itself. In the 1980s, Nancy Shepherd Hughes and Margaret Locke rethought illness in terms of mind-body-society interactions, and they wrote, quote, "As we struggle to explore the illness experience from a perspective that entails an appreciation of humans as simultaneously physical, social, economic, and symbolic beings, we're without a language, and so we're left hanging in mid-air, suspended in hyphens that testify to the radical disconnectedness of our thoughts. We resort to such fragmented concepts as the biosocial, the psychosomatic, the psychosocial. As I attempt to conceive of the myriad ways environments and people interact, I find myself again left hanging. And I hope this term, suspended in hyphens though it is, will be helpful to our understanding and actions in relation to health. With enviroanthropogenesis, I propose the simultaneous co-production of environments and people. They might reinforce, support, transform, perhaps even heal each other, and they might deform, injure, toxify, and even destroy each other. And I would argue that we see hints of these processes in the news these last days in many parts of the world. Bodies of land and water, as well as entire ecologies, may be made and unmade by social formations such as colonialism's construction of material infrastructure, canals, roads, dams, and enclosures or camps. They might be transformed by ideological or racialized blocs who enact walls, detention centers, bombs, drones, and wars. Environments may be remade by the hierarchies and practices of plantation and plantation-like societies historically and contemporarily. And they may be cared for or injured by solution-oriented high-tech agriculture, grassroots movements for environmental sustainability, and the political responses to them, including climate agreements and denials. Each of these realities takes place in the context of people, including indigenous societies, adapting to and modifying waterways and the organization of plants and animals in ways that persist with multi-species flourishing over the long durée. From California, I think of centuries of extractive relations alongside specific policies of natural park protection, ignoring indigenous knowledge and ecological cycles that, along with increasingly dry months and high winds, lead to wildfires that destroy human and non-human habitat. This destruction has significant effects on physical and mental health, leaving many of us in fear of the natural parks around us. On the other hand, people as bodies and social formations are simultaneously assembled and disassembled by environmental formations. Protected waterways and natural parks in Europe irrigate the intensification of industrial agriculture, following what some scholars call a California model that adheres the maximum use of water, pesticides, and plastics, as well as the maximum exploitation of the bodies of workers, often racialized and othered through immigration policy and xenophobia. Borderlands emptied of habitability solidify and make lethal ethno-racial hierarchies, differentially protecting or injuring specific categories of bodies. Clean or polluted airways and waterways may ameliorate or intensify sickness differentially along specific populations. And mountains granted legal rights by courts participate in more than human democracies, similar to the Parliament of Things proposed by Bruno Latour. Here I think of James Scott's book on zomia, in which specific plants allow people to be mobile and not to be subsumed under specific governance regimes. I think of the sacrifice zone surrounding the Ilva steel plant in Italy that produces high rates of cancer in humans and required the slaughtering of animals on which local populations had long depended due to high rates of dioxins. Enviroanthropogenesis reminds us that the separation between environments and people are not easily drawn, and that careful thinking with hyphens might be necessary as we develop new language to understand and respond to these relations. As a simple example, as people walk through a field over time, a path develops, modifying the geography of plants, soil, and snails. That changing geography then focuses the route taken by other humans, and so on. I'm sure you can think of other examples. One simple one that's not in the time frame I'm thinking about is in this room with the air conditioning broken, all of us being here together for hours raises the temperature, meaning that some of us have to take off our jackets because it's too hot. So thank you for bearing with us today. I think of environments on two related levels. First, on the more local level of bodies of water and landscapes, I think of rivers, lakes, deserts, mountains, neighborhoods, farmlands, and mining pits. These are entities that Sunara Taylor has shown we name only if we perceive them as useful to society, capitalism, and production. If we consider these environmental bodies useful and name them, we see them as worthy of care if toxified or sick. Taylor argues that if such bodies of water and land are not seen as useful, they're understood not to deserve care, and links this then to valuations of different human bodies. On the second level, I think of environments on a zoomed out ecological scale in which such bodies of water and landscapes are in relation in broader geographies of interconnection. When I speak of people, I think again on two overlapping levels. First, of individuals, of bodies, the bodies Michel Foucault analyzed as being disciplined on what he called the anatomopolitics level of biopower, which are also bodies that who feel and experience, or what Shepherd Hughes and Locke describe as, quote, mindful bodies. Second, I think of people on the broader level of social formations. I see the social formation as not just the society, but also the relationship between the society and the people positioned as other, against whom that society might define itself. Foucault lectured about the biopolitical level of biopower as the relations between the population whose life must be protected and controlled, and the group he called in his lectures simply the people who are left to die because they're framed as a threat to that population, including through biological racism. From my own research, I think of supply chains and hierarchies, of societies that consider migrant farm workers completely other or separate, at the same time that they're fully reliant on, in bodily, social, and economic ways, those migrant farm workers. Samuel, one of my research interlocutors with whom I spoke yesterday about the public charge worries in the US, shared his analysis that President Trump could not make racist statements about Mexicans or write executive orders against immigrants without the energy from fruits and vegetables harvested by Mexican and other Latin American immigrants. I'll move quickly through one possible genealogy. Locke, Niewuhrner, and others propose that our biologies are situated. The environments in which we develop affect our biology. For example, some of the things we have heard today, including the increasingly robust research into the ways life experiences affect epigenetics, expressing some genes and not others. Human biology is not a single universal constant, but rather influenced by physical, social, political, and economic conditions, as well as knowledge systems. With enviroanthropogenesis, I'm trying to focus on the mutual interaction between the biologies situated by environments, as well as the environmental situations simultaneously affected by those biological bodies and the social systems they form. As the trajectory of climate change has become more pronounced, scholars, practitioners, and social movements consider how human bodies relate to finite ecologies. One Health and Planetary Health consider the connections between the health of humans, animals, and environments. And more recently, Planetary Well-Being, proposed by environmental health scholars in Barcelona, focuses on health and well-being on three scales: human health, the health and well-being of the society itself, and the health of the environment. Taking planetary well-being as a jumping-off point, enviroanthropogenesis draws our imaginations to consider the mechanisms through which these different scales are in relation. Other scholarship focuses less on health while theorizing human-environment interactions. For example, scholars from geology to the humanities write of the Anthropocene, to consider the largely damaging aspects of humanity, such as anthropogenic pollution and the carbon-centered economy that pushed the Earth out of the Holocene era. Others argue that what moved us to this crisis from the backdrop of continuous change in coexistence is not humanity per se, but relations of power. Environmental historian Jason Moore argues that the Capitalocene may be more appropriate to understand how capitalist relations, not all of humanity throughout history, changed the Earth. Others, including geographer Janae Davis, utilize the Plantationocene to make explicit the inequities of our current era. They focus not only on the modernization, homogenization, and control of environments, including through monocrop cultivation, but also on the hierarchies and violences within humanity itself. Thinking with the plantation demands attention to, one, human control over nature; two, the displacement and enclosure of indigenous people inherent to the seizure of land; and three, violent control over racialized people and their labor, from slavery in the Caribbean to the mistreatment of migrant agricultural workers in North America and Europe today. Sylvia Winter also highlights the plot of land provided to slaves on plantations to grow their own food, which also became a common space in which sociality and resistance developed. From these discussions, Christiana Bastos, Deborah Heath, and others played on a formulation from Vincent Desprez to discuss plant anthropogenesis, which they call a concept method. They highlight the entanglements between plants and people over historical time. They point out that, quote, like people, plants are workers of a particular sort: sugar canes, pineapples, grapevines, berries, to mention just a few, work alongside the humans in the fields where they grow, in the mills and factories where they're transformed into products, in the markets that price them and shape human and vegetal destinies, and in the categories that organize social existence, hierarchies, class, and race. Plants also actively work in counterplantation gardens and small plots. In discussions of plant anthropogenesis, we began to realize that it's not just plants doing work alongside and on humans, but also minerals, rivers, canals, and landscapes themselves. Bastos and I began to think with enviroanthropogenesis to consider how environments and people influence and produce each other over time, as well as how they relate to health inequities. So next, I'll walk through some of the empirical research that pushed me to understand health and sickness as inherently interconnected human, social, and environmental realities. Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, which was published in French last year, grew out of a project in which I followed indigenous Triqui Mexican migrant farm workers in Mexico and the US. These families speak Triqui, their indigenous language, and preceded the arrival of Spaniards to Latin America by hundreds of years. They differ from mestizo Mexicans, whose ancestry is a mix of indigenous and Spanish, and whom many Europeans and North Americans imagine when they hear the word Mexican. The research sought to understand the ways in which social hierarchies affected the health of indigenous Triqui migrant farm workers. Originally, I focused primarily on the ways in which social hierarchies impacted health, and today I'm beginning to rethink that research through enviroanthropogenesis, drawing out some of the roles of the environment in relation to health. This transnational project involved multi-sited or multi-situated fieldwork accompanying indigenous Triqui migrants from Oaxaca, which is one of the economically poorest states in Mexico, with one of the highest proportions of indigenous population. In rural Washington State and California, I lived in migrant labor camps, harvested berries and pruned vineyards, accompanied migrant workers to clinics and hospitals, and interviewed farm employees, physicians and nurses, and area residents. Next, I spent several months in the Triqui home village of San Miguel in the mountains of Oaxaca, Mexico, harvesting and planting corn and observing interactions in the village's clinic. And in spring, I was invited to accompany young men from the village as they ventured to a border town, made contact with a coyote or a border crossing guide, and crossed the desert into Arizona, were apprehended by the Border Patrol and put in Border Patrol jail. And I've returned to visit each of these sites multiple times since. This ethnographic research showed some of the contours of the social formation of intensive agriculture with different roles on farms. These positions then correlate with body position in work, immigration status, language spoken, ethnicity, as well as geographic position and housing quality, all related to the y-axis, which is from most to least respect, health, financial security, and control over one's time and others' labor. So it's a multiple y-axis. Made by a medical doctor and anthropologist. Working and living conditions within this formation map onto hierarchies of citizenship and ethnicity, with undocumented indigenous Triqui people inhabiting the bottom rung of the hierarchy with the most stressful, humiliating, and physically strenuous jobs, with the most exposure to weather and pesticides, while they live in the coldest, wettest shacks in the most hidden labor camp. The spatial organization and the legal approval of the conditions of labor camps for Mexican workers are made possible historically by social hierarchies, housing regulations, and immigration policies that are themselves made thinkable by longer histories of U.S. imperialism and European colonialism in Latin America. In other words, this specific environment is produced by social formations over the long durée. And the labor camp, in a sense, then, produces and reinforces categorizations of racialized workers who are understood to belong to those conditions. These living and working conditions, then, lead directly to health inequalities. In the US, agricultural workers in general have an occupational fatality rate 5 times higher than average. More specifically, migrant and seasonal farm workers experience increased rates of injuries, HIV, tuberculosis, heat stroke, anxiety, sterility, liver and kidney disease. And the Center for Disease Control recently found that migrant farm workers die from heat 20 times more than national average. Yet despite this poor health status, migrant farm workers face many barriers to healthcare. Despite the increased occupational injury rate, farm workers are excluded from workers' compensation benefits, including healthcare, in most states. and indigenous Mexican migrants have significantly lower rates of health insurance than their mestizo Mexican counterparts. Finally, right now in the US, as well as last week on public transportation in Paris, undocumented immigrants, as well as some documented immigrants and even citizens, are being detained and families separated, with the all too expected harm to health and access to healthcare. The social hierarchy inherent to industrial agriculture falls along and reinforces these lines of citizenship, race, and class in society. North American and European societies requiring cheap fresh fruit and vegetables produce plantation-like monocrop fields. Geographer Julie Guthman shows how the strawberry plants developed to keep up with demand in monocrop agriculture have become utterly reliant on pesticides, fumigants, and fertilizers, and even more so as the climate changes. These fields then demand ongoing and continuous chemical spraying, bending over, cutting, picking, as well as lifting and carrying fruits and vegetables, while these repetitive movements in context of heavy machinery, increasing heat, and sometimes wildfire smoke cause the injuries, hormonal dysregulation, and even death that make up the health inequities outlined earlier. While industrial agriculture contributes significantly to climate change through synthetic fertilizers, machinery, livestock, and practices of deforestation and monocrop plantings, the increasing number of extreme weather events each year cause harm and death differentially along class, race, and citizenship lines. Here we see other ways in which social formations produce specific environments that in this case solidify class and racialized hierarchies and produce different human bodies. Those of the migrant farm worker with specific exposures and injuries, and those of the consumer nourished by industrially produced fruits and vegetables year round. So how do these interrelations between social, environmental, and health inequalities come to be taken for granted? In agriculture, what Pierre Bourdieu calls symbolic violence operates along the lines of perceptions of ethnic bodies. Bourdieu explains symbolic violence as the naturalization, including internalization, of social asymmetries. He explained that we perceive the social world through historically accreted schemata of perception, which here I'll call lenses, that are issued forth from that social world. These lenses then reflect the social structures to which we've become accustomed. Thus, we misrecognize the social order as natural because that which we're perceiving matches the lenses through which we perceive it. The inequalities comprising the social world are thus made invisible or normal for all involved. When I asked a mestiza Mexican social worker why Triqui people have only berry picking jobs, she explained, "A los Oaxaqueños les gusta trabajar agachados. Oaxacans like to work bent over." Whereas she told me mestizo Mexicans get too many pains if they work in the field. Later, I asked the farm's apple crop manager why I hadn't seen any Triqui people harvesting apples, which is the field job with the highest pay. And he explained, "Oaxacans are too short to reach the apples. They're too slow. They have to use ladders a lot more than some of the other guys, and besides, they don't like ladders anyway." He continued that Oaxacans are perfect for picking berries, quote, "because they're lower to the ground," unquote. The same thing a California senator said in a hearing about migrant labor. In turn, this naturalization of their position bent over picking berries also justifies their increased exposure to pesticides, fertilizers, and fumigants. These perceptions of bodily difference along ethnic lines serve as the lenses through which symbolic violence is enacted. In this way, each category of body is understood to deserve its social and geographic position. Because of what's perceived to be their natural characteristics, indigenous Mexican bodies are understood to belong picking berries, living in labor camps, as opposed to other positions. On the other hand, mestizo Mexicans and white Americans are understood to have bodies that don't fit well in the picker category and belong in other places. The ongoing injury inherent to segregated labor on the farm is so effectively erased precisely because its disappearance takes place at the level of the body and is thus understood to be quintessentially natural. In this way, the social and historical production of the unequal environment that over time exposes and injures the bodies of migrant farm workers becomes legitimized. In society at large, legitimizations of social and health inequities affecting migrant farm workers fall along the lines of empirically erroneous conflations of immigration with criminality. President Trump, for example, called Mexicans bad hombres, and now states that his current mass immigration raid and detention program is deporting criminals, while the judges with whom I spoke in my research shared that the majority of undocumented immigrants are more law-abiding than the average US citizen. Such legitimizations of inequality also conflate territory with people, following what Loïc Facon terms territorial stigmatization. In a recursive intensification, the territory of Mexico and of Oaxaca specifically are stigmatized as less modern and poor, and the people from those places are perceived through that same stigmatization. The stigmatization of those territories and people developed in relation to histories of transnational and internal imperialism is at times used to justify the displacement of indigenous people from their land in Mexico and the unequal environments in which they live and work in the United States. In healthcare, akin to what Michel Foucault termed the clinical or medical gaze, the physicians who treated tricky migrant farm workers utilized narrow lenses that decontextualized sickness, understanding it not in relation to the social or environmental formations in which it developed, but in relation only to individual biology or behavior. While hardworking and well-meaning, clinicians often told workers that they caused their own musculoskeletal injuries due to their behaviors, including, quote, not knowing how to bend over correctly, unquote. When seeking care for headaches or anxiety caused by discriminatory treatment on farms, including differential assignment of housing and work position, workers were not offered support for change in their work or living environment, but rather therapy for their individual behavioral health. The social formation of biomedicine then draws attention away from and functionally hides the social and environmental inequalities that produce injured and sick bodies unequally. At the same time, indigenous migrant farm workers confronted these social and environmental inequalities, organizing strikes to demand fair pay without wage theft, an end to racist name-calling and preferential promotion of people from specific backgrounds, and improvements in the labor camps where they live, cook, sleep, and celebrate birthdays and baptisms. They sued the state to demand they be paid according to the legal minimum wage, and they pushed for policies to protect all farm workers from heat stress and heat stroke. These strategies of resistance then led to transformations of social formations, environments, and health, reworking some of the relationships of enviro-anthropogenesis in which we all live. More recently, graduate students and I worked with a binational indigenous Mexican-led organization to study the experiences of indigenous Mexican farm worker families during the COVID pandemic, who were among multiple populations declared essential workers by the government. One of the findings most striking and painful to me was that 73% of the farm worker households in our study experienced food insecurity, defined as the inability to eat two full meals a day. 48% reported being able to eat only one full meal a day, and 25% reported not being able to eat even one full meal in a day. People interviewed explained the primary drivers of their lack of food, including the temporary nature of their jobs. Most have no access to work outside the harvest seasons. With the high cost of living in California, families reported multiple people sharing apartments with non-functional heat and air conditioning, and having to choose between medical care and buying food. This severe food insecurity experienced by the people who provide fruit and vegetables for North American societies elucidates one aspect of enviroanthropogenesis, in which the demands of industrial food systems requiring fresh produce year-round injure not only landscapes and waterways through deforestation and intensive monoculture, but also debilitate, in the words of Jasbir Puar, the workers essential to the systems. At the same time, research has shown that food insecurity worsens chronic diseases, decreases mental health, as well as educational attainment of children, itself shown in multiple studies to influence social and environmental position, as well as health through the life course. Here again, we see the co-production of unequal human and environmental formations also producing different bodies, some nourished and others nourishing. Finally, I'll briefly describe collaborative work to highlight the health implications of the co-production of environments and people. This article comes from a series of what we call social medicine cases, jointly analyzed by clinicians and social scientists. In this case, Mr. H is a 32-year-old migrant farm worker from Mexico who experienced wrist overuse injuries common among people harvesting blueberries in the state of Maine. After conducting what we call a structural differential to understand the ways social, political, and economic structural forces led to his injury, his clinicians worked with him, farm worker representatives, and engineers to design new blueberry rakes to protect the wrists of workers. Of course, a new rake doesn't directly change the social formation, nor the specifics of blueberry field environments, but the redesigned rake changes the processes through which the environment produces bodies, ameliorating its injurious effects. And perhaps the collaboration between farm workers, clinicians, and engineers may be one small local step in challenging social separations. And this spring, a related research project already underway that Muriel Darmon participated in to analyze cases from around the world jointly between medicine, social sciences, and humanities was terminated by the new US government, with funds demanded to be returned, and graduate students and others working on the project suddenly left without funding for their work on the day the email was received. Such grant terminations after approval, contract signing, distribution of funds, and the beginning of research is rather unprecedented and seems to go against contract law. The emerging anti-science, anti-dissent, authoritarian social and political formation in the US is deliberately cutting short collaborations that could theorize and potentially change this mutual production of social, environmental, and health inequalities. This slide is from the Structural Competency Working Group that I'm a part of in the Bay Area and around the world, highlighting in this first slide that in some research, as Bruce Link and Joe Phelan have pointed out, focused on health disparities, social inequalities are taken for granted, and the focus is on the mechanisms leading to the health disparities. In our group, and learning from Jonathan Metzl, Helena Hansen, and others, we're focusing also on the social structural forces that produce the inequalities in the first place, or what Latin American social medicine scholars like Jaime Braille call the social determination of health as a verb and process. This is a framework we've been developing to train health professionals in critical thinking about the social production of health inequalities. So what might it mean to add the role and action of environments into this framework? In the working group, we show the importance of structural processes through clinical examples. For example, Mr. M, whose experiences I'll move through very quickly just to give you a rough idea. According to the medical chart, Mr. M is drinking and found unconscious and taken into the emergency room. And that's what the clinicians know about him and Mark in the record. But if we ask more questions and get to know him more, we learn he's a fourth generation corn farmer in Oaxaca. There was an influx of cheap US corn, so he couldn't make a living. He had to move to California, where he started working as a day laborer. He was injured on the job, had to move out of his housing, and lived on the street where he was assaulted and began drinking. So this, what we are thinking of as the social determinants of his life course, then affect how clinicians or health systems understand him as deserving or not. But if we think, perhaps with enviroanthropogenesis, about the socio-environmental structures that are affecting his life course, we might think about the systematic marginalization and displacement from land of indigenous communities in Mexico, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and the state-subsidized monocrop corn production. We might think of the lack of health insurance for immigrants in the US, about racialized low-wage labor markets and housing geographies, about punitive immigration policies and borders, and city and state policies that lead to high rents and displacement. Not to mention border regimes and geographies where people need to move through dangerous deserts and extreme heat and extreme weather that especially affects people without housing in urban environments. This diagram also hints at the recursive production of environments and people. Hierarchical social formations based in extraction and accumulation produce environments increasingly inhospitable to specific groups of people who are displaced and become positioned in the boundary work of transnational social formations, increasingly anxious about racialized others in the midst of anxieties over and denials of finite resources and climate change. So this is one attempt to incorporate enviroanthropogenesis into a framework to both understand health and train health professionals. To understand the embodied connections between people categorized as migrants and people categorized as society, I'm grateful to be working with a team of brilliant postdoctoral and doctoral researchers in an ERC project called Food Circuits. Each of them is focusing on a specific circuit of fruit or vegetable understood through regional or national identities, what we might think of as gastronationalism or gastroregionalism. Following these fruits and vegetables and all the embodied people who come into contact with them, from agriculture to supply chains to consumption, we want to understand how such connections become invisibilized. And visual anthropologist Alessandra Tatic is leading us in developing visual data to analyze this more directly. Some of the photos from her and other researchers I'm using today. We discuss and theorize our field research together regularly, tracing connections between people, environments, and health. And we experiment with collaborative research alongside food circuit workers themselves, some of whom also come to work in France through temporary work companies that Frederic Decosse, Emmanuel Elio, Anna Portilla, and others have studied. Our joint discussions contribute, for me, to the need and opportunity for a new paradigm or concept method. Today, I'll share brief preliminary findings intercalating people and environments. Postdoc Mael Vizcarra's fieldwork in the California strawberry circuit highlights how monocrop industrial farming is a continual attempt to subjugate land, yet the furrows between strawberry rows are impossible to keep completely flat and even, not only because the machinery and production practices are aimed at maximizing planting, but also because the earth refuses to be tamed, weeds grow, puddles appear and sink away, and strawberry plants sprout offshoots. This is the uneven ground through which farm workers move, hunched over heavy metal carts holding cardboard flats to be filled with strawberries, and because they're paid per box, many workers run back and forth to fill their boxes as quickly as possible, leading to chronic and acute ankle and knee injuries. I won't read a quote about the ways in which the asparagus and asparagus fields have allowed people from East Germany to survive with the fall of the wall and people coming from West Germany and buying more land. And I won't talk very much about, and the previous research was by Alexandra Voivozianu and Hanna Wadle, and this research by Paul Sperniak-Wolfer in greenhouses in Austria, looking at the effects of heat on bodies, specifically on Romanian workers, and the ways in which this taxing heat and work has led to Austrian farmers' hope of the figure of the Nepali worker, who is positioned as especially physically resistant to heat, such that this group of racialized and geographically imagined bodies are cast as capable of continuing this agricultural project. So each of these brief vignettes, this is my last slide, signals an aspect of what I'm thinking of through enviroanthropogenesis. From systems of food production and imperfect control over nature producing injured ankles, to asparagus fields allowing family survival, to specific racializations in humid microenvironments. So today, I want to leave us with a set of questions. In what ways might asparagus fields produce different bodies than greenhouses? Do strawberry fields and migrant labor camps maintain national identities and borders? More broadly, what does the labor of migrant workers, plants, waterways, and landscapes that's incorporated into the food we eat demand of us? And what is the analytical and political potential in hyphens as we seek to understand in new ways the connections between hierarchies of people and environments? So if we as social scientists, health professionals, and members of society in this amphitheater are to orient toward decreasing social health inequalities, what will thinking with enviroanthropogenesis lead us to change in our research questions or methods, in clinics and health systems, social, housing, and immigration policies, and the EU's common agricultural policy? We're in a historic moment of attacks on populations and bodies, landscapes and ecologies, as well as research and education. Enviroanthropogenesis invites us to direct our attention toward connections, denaturalizing social inequalities, challenging symbolic violence, territorial stigmatization, and narrow gazes. And this line of thinking might encourage us to foster connections and coalitions across differences to protect and care for one another in our more than human environments. Thanks.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.